I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how greatness emerges from the fissures of pain. When a young woman went in for straightforward surgery to correct scoliosis, she expected to wake up and quickly get back to normal. Instead, she woke up and wasn't able to move her legs, a rare complication of a procedure intended to shore up a standout athlete. Nnedi Okorafor was broken. Not sure she'd ever walk again, she turned to writing, crafting wildly creative stories and feeling herself become greater along the way. We'll talk to her about seeing inspiration and creativity in the unexpected and about how she was able to use her pain as a launchpad. Our conversation starts after a short break. Okorafor is a household name when it comes to science fiction writing. From The Book of Phoenix to Black Panther comics, her creativity within the world of sci-fi is much praised. What many people don't know, perhaps, is that a surgery gone wrong is what inspired her passion and helped shape her into the person she is today. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. It was supposed to be a routine procedure to correct scoliosis, but when she came out of the anesthesia, she couldn't move her legs. What followed was a grueling battle to walk again and a period of discovery that led to greatness. Nnedi Okorafor writes about that experience in Broken Places and Outer Spaces, Finding Creativity in the Unexpected. Nnedi, welcome back to Think.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to be here again.
So scoliosis was in your family. Your siblings had it, but you had it the worst.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny. I don't know if anyone like my parents or before that, but my siblings, we all have it. My brother even has it, and girls are the ones who tend to get it. But mine was definitely the worst.
So why did you decide to have this procedure? And what was it? A spinal fusion?
Yeah, it was a spinal fusion. It wasn't really a decision so much as the doctors looked at my, over the years, I was diagnosed with scoliosis when I was 13, and over those years, they tried all these different ways to stop it, but my scoliosis was really, really aggressive. I had a back brace, I did the exercises, all of that, even while I was doing sports, and by the time I was 19, they took an x-ray and looked at it, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse. So they were like, well, you have two quote-unquote choices. You could not do anything about this, and by the time you're 25, you'll be crippled, and your life will be significantly shortened, or you can have this surgery. So, yeah, it was a choice, but, yeah, it was a special choice.
Right. And you said you did sports. You were a pretty serious athlete at the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Athletics were my life. I was playing semi-pro tennis from the age of 9 with my sisters and I. We were like the Venus and Serena before Venus and Serena. And that's how I got to see the United States, was being on the nationals, playing the national circuit. So tennis was my life. And then on top of that, I also knew I'd be good at, and that I'd love track and field. But because tennis dominated so much of my life for so many years, I didn't get to go on the track team. And then in my senior year, I finally took some time and went on the track team. And that proved to be, you know, I proved to be correct. I won over 22 medals that year, went to state, placed in state. I mean, you know, the athletics were very much, that's always been my identity since I was a kid.
And so you're the absolute picture of health. You're young. I mean, you have scoliosis. Mm-hmm. It needs to be corrected, but I mean, you couldn't be in any better shape. I'm guessing the surgery was pitched to you as a pretty straightforward situation.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was told that I would be back on the tennis court in a matter of weeks, that a lot of athletes have this surgery, and it would only make me a little bit taller. And, you know, so it was pitched to me as something that it was serious. It was definitely there was a 1% chance of paralysis. But when you're like, you know, I'm 19 years old, I hear that's basically nothing. I mean, you're dealing with the spinal cord. I mean, there's always going to be some kind of risk. But yeah, it seemed, you know, like it was just going to be standard, that it was something that had to be done. It was serious, but not something to worry about.
So you go into surgery, and then when you wake up, do you know something is wrong immediately, or are you just coming out of anesthesia and not sure exactly what you're dealing with?
Oh my gosh, it was. I had I was on morphine for, you know, for the pain. And so, like, I, you know, I don't drink, I don't do anything, you know, it's only water. And so they put that in my system and it just did crazy things to my point of view. So when I woke up, it was like, I didn't know I was paralyzed. I didn't know for a while, you know, I didn't know for, it's like a day or 2 days or maybe 3 days. And, but when I woke up, I was having these massive hallucinations from the morphine. So I'm seeing, I love bugs. I've always loved bugs. And so I'm seeing grasshoppers, fluorescent green and pink grasshoppers and praying mantises clicking and jumping around my room. So that took up my attention for a little while. So I when I woke up, no idea that I was paralyzed.
And the scene where you describe the grasshoppers and praying mantises, there's a crow too, right, outside the window?
Yes, there was a crow. Yes.
So did you try to communicate this or did you have to just kind of exist in this hallucination for a long time?
I just existed. It was like, you know, I've always been a very imaginative person. So there was that. That helped a lot. but, you know, so I'm just sitting there just like looking around and observing, and the hallucinations were very detailed. Like they would come close and I could see the detail of their legs and their thoraxes, all of that. So I kind of just rolled with it. It was surreal, to say the least. Yeah, I just kind of looked at it happening. I mentioned it to my parents, and after I told them, they were like, "Okay, we need to get you off the morphine." But yeah, it wasn't freaking out. It was I just kind of rolled with it. Yeah.
But then some time passes and something is wrong. You cannot move your legs, not an inch, not a twitch.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just a matter of not being able to move my legs. It was I couldn't roll over. I couldn't even turn because it was the waist down. So when you're paralyzed from the waist down, you can't even, you know, turn to get in a more comfortable position. It's like half of your, and for me, I have very long legs, so it's over half of my body. It's like 2/3 of my body was gone. Like literally I could not, it was just not there, which was, it was jarring, beyond jarring.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, I mean, a 19-year-old athlete mm-hmm. who just suddenly can't just make her body do anything she wants.
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
It was absolutely stunning. It was like, because athletics, it wasn't just that I was an athlete and competitive. It was deeper than that. The ability to move freely, I could run the fastest, I could jump the highest, I could walk on my hand, I was extremely athletic. That's the only way to put it. Movement was so easy for me. Mm-hmm. And so to take somebody like that and suddenly paralyze them, like suddenly where it's not expected, you have no idea it's coming, and it's fast, just like that. And once I realized it, it was just, that's why I call it breaking, because it was so jarring. You just, you know, I think back to that and it was just, really dark. Things got really dark really fast.
How did the doctors respond? Did they know that something had gone wrong in surgery?
Yes, they did, because my surgeon woke me up. And I don't remember being woken up, but he woke me up and asked me if I could move my legs. And when I couldn't, that's when they knew something was wrong. So yeah, they knew prior.
And what was your prognosis? Did they tell you there's a chance this is permanent, this could come back any minute? I mean, what were you thinking was ahead of you?
They had no idea if it was going to come back. They didn't know what happened. They didn't know what happened. They didn't know if I would ever walk again. They didn't know anything. You know, and that's why I really am thankful to my family, because my family was like, "You're going to walk." It was almost irrational. It was just 100%. You're going to walk. There's no questioning that. And but the doctors, I mean, science is not an exact thing. It's not an exact thing. When things like this happen, they didn't know. And what to do next? I'm sure there was, like, for me, I was in it. I was so in it that I don't know how those discussions went. But I'm sure there was a discussion of what to do next and trying to figure that out, not knowing, because it was just like suddenly we were in an area that we were in the unknown, you know. So they didn't know if the next day something would suddenly start I'd be able to move or if I'd never walk again. They didn't know.
How long were you completely paralyzed? How long were you just without movement in your legs?
I'd say about 2 weeks.
Which probably felt like years.
Yeah, it did. It felt like years. It felt very long. Like 2 weeks is, I mean, that's still long, but like it definitely felt like a very long time because, you know, there were things that I learned. I learned what it is to be paralyzed very quickly, and I went from being this to that, and like there are small details where, you know, you don't, the small details, is those things that you don't think about. I learned all of those in those 2 weeks. And also without knowing what's next, that's the worst part. Like, you don't know, I didn't know if I was going to walk again. I didn't know what to expect. And so it was just all, just a lot of unknown. And then just the only thing that was known was the immediate, the present of, I cannot walk. It's not even, I can't walk. I can't move. You know, I couldn't even like crawl.
It was just gone.
Yeah.
When you look back at those 2 weeks now, knowing that you did, in fact, have movement come back and you are where you are now, what did you think your biggest takeaway from those 2 weeks of complete paralysis? What was that biggest takeaway?
It was a loss of a carefree innocence. And one of the things I did take away was that we don't know everything. We can never know everything. But also that when it happens and when you're in that moment, it's kind of like what I did with the hallucinations. You know, it's like you roll with it. You live in it. You know, I learned to, like, you know, I saw that there was a darkness. There was always a darkness. From the moment I knew that I couldn't move, there was that darkness that was always hovering nearby. And I learned not to go into that darkness. I learned to roll with it, to keep going, even if nothing ever came back. You know, you keep going. You there's always a path to walk on. And I think I learned that in those, you know, in those moments, because before that, I didn't have that. I hadn't had anything really terrible happen to me that was final and that I couldn't. You know, that where you were faced with it, you couldn't turn away. There was no distraction from it. Like, this was my body. There was no, I'd never had that before. So I learned how to keep going, I think, in those moments.
It's so interesting, too, because that's something I noticed when I read about what you were going through is, of course, you can connect with people who lose hope when something like this happens or who feel like there is no path. But that was never, even when you felt deep and dark, that was never kind of where your head was. You were always just trying to figure out a way to exist in whatever your reality was. Why do you think you handled it that way?
I think it's my family. It was definitely my family, because my family, like both of my parents are immigrants, and they've always had this attitude of you go and you do, you know, there're always going to be these obstacles around you, but you still find a way. No matter what those obstacles are, there's always a way, and you just have to get creative. And so like my siblings and I, we were all raised with that attitude, because we grew up with a lot of different things that we had to deal with. And that was what they it wasn't that they told it to us, but it was more showing by doing. And we learned it that way. And so I think my family definitely is where that comes from.
Interesting for a science fiction writer who, you know, you're not bound by just a three-dimensional world as a professional. So why would you live that way?
Yeah. Yeah.
Then one day, we're about to hit the break, but good news, your big toe twitched.
Yes, wiggle your big toe.
And we will get back to your big toe in just a minute. My guest this hour is Nnedi Okorafor. Her book is called Broken Places and Outer Spaces, Finding Creativity in the Unexpected. We'll be right back. think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Nnedi Okorafor. Her book is called Broken Places and Outer Spaces, Finding Creativity in the Unexpected. So Nnedi, right before we went to break, you'd been paralyzed after scoliosis surgery for 2 weeks. You could not move your legs, you couldn't rotate your hips or turn over, and then all of a sudden your big toe twitched. What did that feel like?
It was another surreal moment. It was like, in that moment, it was like my toes were aliens. They were another part of my body, like another entity in themselves. Because at the time when it happened, I was, you know, I had to go through all this physical therapy. Like, we just went into it, even if we didn't know if anything was going to come back. My parents were like, "You're doing this," so I did it because I did anything my parents told me to do. And one of them was this straining to move my toes to, like, my feet in any way, or my legs, any part of my legs, to do something. And so at the time, I was doing that. I was on my bed, my legs were in front of me, and I was drenched in sweat because I was just trying to get something to move. And I'm like begging my legs to do something, and I focused on my toe. And I kept thinking, it was that Kill Bill moment where our main character has a similar situation. So I'm like looking at it and I'm like, "Move, please, please move, please. I will put nail polish on you. I will do anything. Please move." And then it twitched. It twitched. And it was like, it didn't feel like I did it, but I must have done it, of course, but it didn't feel like I did. It was just like it moved because I was begging it to. And that moment, though, was huge because something on my leg moved, which meant I wasn't paralyzed anymore. Like, it was that clean cut for me. Like, in that moment when I saw my toe move, I'm like, okay. You know, okay, now we've there's something here. I went from complete mystery to knowing something, night and day.
Someone opened the window a crack for you.
Yes, exactly. And air rushed in.
So the window was only open a little bit. It's not like the movies. Yeah. It's not like your toe twitched, right, and then you were pirouetting out of bed 5 minutes later. It was
exactly
a long haul for you as far as rehabilitation and recovery. Talk to me about the process of relearning how to move and walk.
Oh, my gosh. There is so much that I couldn't put in the book. That whole part, like the recovery was it wasn't just recovery, it was like relearning was absolutely grueling, because yeah, once I was able to move that toe, it was like I was able to do it again later that day. So it was once you know, it was like something connected in that moment, but I wasn't suddenly able to move my legs within 2 days. It mm-hmm. took a while. So it was like, first it was the toe twitching, and then I could bend it. And then I could twitch the one next to it. It was very, very gradual, and every single step required work, like every step. But I kept going, you know, because once the athlete in me kicked in, and like once I got a taste of that, I'm like, oh, let's do it. Let's make it happen again and again and again. And so gradually, I got to the point where they could put me upright. And I remember the moment they put me on this table that took me from being horizontal to vertical, and like I hadn't been standing, like I hadn't been in a vertical position where I was standing for a long time. And I remember what that felt like. It must have been like what astronauts feel when they come back to Earth, honestly, because I felt like I felt gravity on my body in a way that I hadn't for a while. And so there was that. And then I remember the moment when I first took my first step, because I've always had a really strong upper body, so that definitely helped me learn getting myself to hoist myself up to a standing position. And I remember I was holding myself up, and I had to make my legs take a step, and I had to think every step, pun intended, of the way, where I had to think, okay, lift, move forward, put foot down. I had to think, like, I had to give my legs instructions to do that. And boy, the first time I stood up and took a step was surreal, because like there was another guy and doing his physical therapy right next to me who just decided to start throwing up in a garbage can right next to me
as
I'm trying to do this. So it was just a moment where I had to really focus, really, really focus. Because like those moments where I was hoisting myself up, I was always also afraid of falling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fell, you could re-injure yourself, because I was not fully recovered from just the surgery itself. You could re-injure yourself and make things worse. And I always had this thing in my head. I'm like, okay, if I fall and I re-injure myself, what if it makes me completely paralyzed? Like, so there are all sorts of, there was fear, there was anxiety, there was this guy right next to me doing that, but still I managed to take that step. And so, like, there are moments like that for the whole time of relearning, literally relearning to walk. It was grueling, you know, every aspect of it I had to be focused in and put my all into.
And it's so interesting because obviously relearning a skill like walking would be taxing for any of us. But as you said earlier in this interview, I mean, you were just, you know, frankly, a very gifted athlete, and movement had always been something that didn't just come naturally to you, but that you excelled at. So it must have been bizarre that the one thing you could always count on was the thing that you were having to break down piece by piece.
Yeah. And I think that having that taken away, like something that I was so sure of all my life, something that like one of the greatest talents that I was born with, and then having it suddenly taken away has left, like, even now there's like an anxiety that I constantly feel, like just that anything can go, like randomly for whatever reason, anything can go. It's something that's the one of those things that I deal with every single day. Like every day I wake up and I have to kind of grapple that to the ground because it's created that anxiety, that fear. But you know, you roll with it.
And just like you rolled with that, you also started to kind of gain some really interesting insight and inspiration while you were relearning how to walk. I hope you can describe for our listeners the little clay lady you made.
Oh, the clay lady. Yes. Well, okay. So it started with like the darkest, it was within the first maybe 1 or 2 days where after I realized that I was paralyzed. Those nights, not days, nights, because nights are when things get really dark.
Mm-hmm.
And that in those nights, that's where I was like, okay, I saw that darkness that was always hovering near me. That's when it was closest. And I knew that I could just go into that sweet, sad darkness and not come out. I knew it. And I decided instead to take it in a different direction. That's when I started writing stories. It was in that moment at that really low time where I knew I had to do something, I had to look elsewhere. And I started writing these little stories on the edges of a friend of mine had brought a copy of iRobot.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing these just stories to myself. And one of those was about a flying woman, you know, and I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't thinking. It was a flying woman. And when I think back, you know, when you can fly, you don't have to walk.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't thinking about that. So this flying woman was already like this created kind of character in my mind. And so when I was able to move around a little better, and this was before I could actually stand up even a little, I was still in the wheelchair. But there was one day where I was in the wheelchair, and getting in the wheelchair was an ordeal in itself. But I was in the wheelchair and I felt a sense of freedom. I could move around. You know, I was moving myself around. And I remember I went down the hall away from my room. I went down the hall where some kids were playing, doing crafts. And these were kids in recovery. And they had they had popsicle sticks and clay. And they were just doing stuff with their hands. And I've always loved doing that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just decided to join them. And I molded from clay the lady that I had created in that small story. And you know, and I remember I made her very specific. I made her really tall, and gave her really big boobs. And I don't know, it was just I was creating. And and I remember I brought her back with me. And this clay lady, she just stayed with me. And like those are two forms of of storytelling that I was doing. I didn't know it at the time, but they were two forms, and I found them very satisfying, and I realized that while I was doing both of them, the writing and the creating with my hands, it's not that I escaped, but I just felt whole. You know, I felt whole when I was doing that, and that was something that stayed with me. That was something that I remembered. I don't know what happened to the clay lady, but the creating of her stayed with me.
And that is what was really interesting and struck me when I was reading. You never really talk about creative expression while you were either in the hospital or at home, or even past that, is something that helped you like survive this experience. Mm-hmm. But you really talked about it as this experience made you greater and incorporated that into your life. You see it a little bit differently than anyone else. And how come you don't view it as kind of a distraction or a way to get through something, but is a way to build yourself up?
I think that that's just like, that's a personal philosophy of mine. I've never been one to escape something. Like, I don't run away from things. I tend to go into them. I tend to lean into them. That's always been the way I've handled things, you know? And I think that's the genesis of that, because like I think of all the issues that I've dealt with over the years, I've never wanted to run, which is that's another pun. I have a lot of these puns of walking and stepping and running, but I just don't tend to do that, and it's not that I think about it. It's just that's just my personality, I guess.
How long were you in the hospital from surgery to release?
It was about a month. It was about a month.
And then you went home, and I'm guessing, again, you weren't in perfect shape at that point. You were still recovering.
Yeah, no. When I went home, at that time I was still using the wheelchair, mm-hmm. and I was using a walker. And using the walker was extremely difficult. Like, it was scary. It was like I just always felt like I was going to fall and that I was going to re-injure myself. So, yeah, when I returning home was another step in a lot of ways, the trauma of the whole thing, because I had left so sure, and I'd left like looking forward to the surgery, because I'm like, oh, finally my back isn't gonna look the way it looked. You know, I'm finally gonna look semi-normal for once. I was really looking forward to that, and I was very optimistic, and here I am returning in this state. And it wasn't really that long of a period of time. And so my room was the same. I still had all of my medals. I still had my track, the number that you put on your back from state. That was still there. Everything was still, from who I was before, was still there. All the reminders were right in my room. And I returned to that. And it's like, I remember when I got to my room, I just stood there looking around. And I think that, like, I've always had that eye for detail that storytellers have. So I saw all the details, like all the little things, like I could see it, like just the slightest thing held story to me. So when I looked around my room, it was like, oh man, everything was just slamming into me. The enormity of what happened was slamming into me. So like from the moment I stepped into my bedroom, home was, you know, it was great to be home, but at the same time, the reminders were there of what I'd lost. And so I had to deal with it in an even more blunt way.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. So you're home, eventually you're going to go back to school, and you kind of changed up your course of study. I thought it was really interesting. You had planned to do something with medicine.
Yeah, I was pre-med. I had actually planned to become an entomologist, because mm-hmm. I loved bugs and I wanted to study bugs, and University of Illinois has a really great entomology program, and I was really excited about that. And so that was my, and since I was little, like everyone knew me as the bug lady, you know, I was the one who would go into the bushes and catch things and classify things. And I was like I still am a walking encyclopedia. but when I returned, oh, a lot of things happened. It was just, I was writing, first of all. Like I didn't know I was writing. I didn't have a name for it. I didn't label myself. No one ever told me this is what you're doing. I didn't show it to my siblings or my parents. They didn't even know I was doing it. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just doing it. And so I returned doing that, you know, telling these stories to myself, just because I love doing it. That was one thing I discovered. I loved it. I loved it so much. So I was doing that, and also the experience had kind of really messed up my views of science. Both of my parents are doctors, and they're very science-oriented. But for me, it destroyed a lot. Like, my faith in science was greatly shaken. So there was that. So those two things combined, you know, led to... And then also, I had a friend who looked at the things that I was writing, and he was like, you should take a creative writing class. And I didn't even know what creative writing was at the time. And, you know, I had such a crush on him that I took the class.
Good idea.
And it was, yeah, he still tries to take credit for my career. but, like, I took the class, and by the next semester, like, that class showed me what I was doing. It gave me a name to what I was doing. I was like, oh, you know, and then I knew, and I wrote my first official short story. And I knew at that point it was like discovering the thing, you know. I knew I'd found it. I knew I'd find, and I just loved it, and I was good at it, and I wanted to keep doing that. So literally by the end of that next semester after the creative writing class, I was writing a novel, and it was just a story that went on and on and on that was huge, and it took a long time. And then eventually I changed my major to rhetoric at U of I. Rhetoric is creative writing, and I. You know, everything shifted. Everything shifted. Like, my chemistry classes and physics and all that. It's like, I love them, but still, like, I had lost my faith in the sciences, you know. So, yeah, that combination led to the shift as well.
My guest this hour is Nnedi Okorafor. Her book is called Broken Places and Outer Spaces, Finding Creativity in the Unexpected. Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Nnedi Okorafor. Her book is called Broken Places and Outer Spaces, Finding Creativity in the Unexpected. So, Nnedi, the whole book is not just about this paralysis and then your recovery and how it shaped you as a writer. You also include some really interesting stories about your childhood, and including a couple upsetting tales when you were harassed with your siblings and people yelled racist taunts at you and you were chased through your neighborhood. Why did you include those stories in this book?
Because... you know, for me to talk about the incident that happened, I felt like I needed to give context, because it wasn't just this thing that happened to an athlete. Mm-hmm. This is like a full body effect, and I felt like that context was definitely necessary, especially the parts about where I grew up and how I grew up, because my family was played a really big role in my recovery, and also my athleticism was something that helped me through a lot. But also I needed to include all of that to tell this story, because this story is very much about identity as well. So I had to explain all sides of my identity that are connected to what happened. And in order to do that, you had to see that aspect too.
What was it like growing up with your siblings in your neighborhood? I mean, it's hard for many people to imagine what you guys had to endure and how you seemingly did it without despair, but with a lot of strength. Where did that strength come from?
Yeah, I grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, South Holland, Illinois in particular, and I was lucky that I could run fast. I'll say that. It was South Holland. It was very much like it had a Spielberg-esque kind of feel to it. It was a suburb. It was the 80s, and, you know, the kids were always outside. You played outside, and there was a lot of space. Everybody knew everyone. When you wanted to go play with your, when you wanted to play with your friends, you'd go to your friend's house, like, two doors over or even right next door and knock on the door and say, can so-and-so come out? That was, so, like, there was a beauty to where I grew up. But there was also that underbelly, the racism, because my family, we were one of the first black families to move into this neighborhood. That shouldn't be a problem, but for some, it definitely was. And so we had to hear, along with that rosy side of things, you know, where you've had the empty lots and the flowers and all that, you could just be free. There was that side of it as well. There was that old American form of racism that was there that we had to, my sisters were all, we were each 1 year apart. So I'm the youngest, then my middle sister Ngozi, and then Ifoma, who was my oldest. And then my brother came 7 years later. So he didn't have to deal with a lot of this. But the three of us, we dealt with all of this as a unit. And so, growing up in that environment where we would hear the N-word quite often, we'd have to run quite often, and this was like blended with our friendships as well. It was it was a complex, really interesting time.
It's interesting. A couple of the stories, you kind of run or even kick your way out of, you know, harassment. And I think about the way that you write and the comics and your sci-fi characters. And I mean, do you look back on that girl with the long legs who is racing through the neighborhood and taking care of her sisters and standing strong with them when you write some of your characters today?
I certainly draw from that. Like, I remember those times, like the section in Broken Places in Outer Spaces where I talk about the incident where my sisters and I, we had to run from this group of high school kids. We were 8, 9, and 10 years old. We had to run from this group of very racist high school kids who were trying to beat us up, and we had to outrun them, and we had to also outwit them. Those moments, it's like my sisters and I, we still talk about that. We still talk about that incident because it was surreal. It happened exactly how I described it. And like the exhilaration and the fear and the trying to figure out what are you going to do in this moment, and then being of a certain age and these things being so important, like all of that make it easy to write about certain types of scenes. Certainly, you draw off of those details. It's like one of the best things for writers is to have experience that we can draw from, and you can channel that experience into all kinds of situations. You can channel it into someone who can fly or a superhero or, you know, whatever type of character. So yeah, I've definitely drawn from those experiences in my fiction.
And I think most people who read any of your work, you know, have a guess at the answer to this, but can you describe a bit how family trips to Nigeria when you were younger influenced your work and just also the woman that you are?
Oh, yes. Those trips were everything. My parents were taking us back, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria from a very young age. You know, the first time I went was, I think I must have been around 7 years old. And that was really important. Those trips were really important for my identity, for my sanity, for my understanding of the world, because those trips, they weren't just vacations where you were going to some exotic place. We were going to this place that was on the other side of the planet, that was in Africa, in a country of black people, where most of our relatives were there. So we weren't going as tourists. We were going as family, but we were also outsiders because, you know, we were born and raised in the United States, but we were family. We have similar names. We look like those. We look like our relatives. So it was like we learned about our heritage in those trips early on. And we understood how important that was. And it was clear. And then also we ran wild with our cousins, you know, and we got to meet our grandparents and listen to their stories and our aunts and uncles and taking. So all of that, you know, all of those experiences were were really pivotal to me as a person, because I learned early on, one, that because we were going on these trips at the same time we were dealing with the racism in South Holland, mm-hmm. you know. So it's like early on I learned that the world was really big and diverse, you know, that not every place was like South Holland, Illinois. There's another part of the world where, you know, where everyone is black, and they don't have racism. They have something else called tribalism, mm-hmm. and other conversations are being had. There are many languages in this other place. Like, I just learned early on just how big and diverse the world was. But I also learned, because the racism that we were dealing with was pretty severe, and it was also in tennis as well. We dealt with a lot of racism in tennis in really creative ways. But I learned that, you know, that my identity was solidified by those trips. Like, I knew who I was. I knew where I came from. I knew, you know, that this is part of me and it's okay. And the, you know, the United States is part of me and it's okay. Like, I learned a lot of these really important lessons about identity and about confidence really early. And it was those trips that did it. And my parents weren't like thinking, oh, we need to take our kids back because they need to learn these things. They weren't thinking about it so consciously. They just wanted to see family. Mm-hmm. They wanted to see everybody. And in doing that, they gave us one of the greatest gifts they could have given us as parents.
And yeah, it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because if you learned when you were young that you had to be strong and stand with your siblings in the face of racism in America, and if you got to see the Nigerian tapestry as a part of the world that others would never experience, and then you underwent this bizarre freak injury following a surgery, could you put that all together in your head and think there's a lot going on in the world, it's not one thing, and that's
yes.
going to make it easier for me to find a pathway out of this?
Yes, very, very well said and very well put, because it's all of that, all of those things. And that's part of why when I wrote about this incident, I knew I had to talk about all these issues of identity and all these aspects of identity, the many faces that I have and the many sides that I have, and how they all become one thing, and that one thing is very complex. I think that I've processed all of it pretty well. You know, I feel like I've processed, like I processed the going from being this mega athlete to dealing with this paralysis, and then having to become, figure out who I am, figuring out being American born and with a Nigerian heritage and Nigerian family. I've processed all that very well. And I think it comes back to something I said earlier about facing things. Like I just, even with my American and Nigerian, like, what is she? I don't even know, you know, which you got to choose a side. I've always faced it. I've always been like, look, this is who I am. These are all of my sides. They're conflicting. These are similarities, whatever. But I've always faced it. I've always been ready to engage in those conversations. I've always been ready to ask the questions and ready to look at those things within myself. And the same with the paralysis, where that whole experience, it wasn't something where I wanted to be like, I just never want to talk about that again. You know, I'm just like, okay, let me talk about this. Let me just open this up. And in doing those things and facing those things, it's painful and difficult, but it's really, I feel like I've definitely benefited from that and been able to digest it and incorporate things and become, because I've been able to face those things.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. One of my favorite things that you write in this book is when you say, with a lot of confidence and energy, I am a cyborg. Now, you don't say, I feel as if I was a cyborg. You say, I am a cyborg, which really does, again, speak to identity and confidence. What was that cyborg self that you saw and felt as you were recovering from this injury?
Yeah, it's part of the facing of it. It's like I have to, one, I perfectly understand that I am not normal. When they say, oh, everyone's, look, everyone has the same skeleton, they show a skeleton. That everyone has this in them. I'm like, that's not how my skeleton looks at all. I'm perfectly willing to embrace that. Embrace that, the fact that, like, I am kind of far from the norm when it comes to things like that. And the cyborg aspect is me embracing what I am. And I literally am a rudimentary cyborg. That's what it says on my Twitter, in my Twitter title. Like, I'm a rudimentary cyborg because I have a steel rod lashed against my spine. Like, literally, if I bend forward, I can feel it. You know, so I've got metal in me. I'm part steel, and I embrace that, and I love that, and I'm perfectly perfectly content with that.
And you say throughout the book that you felt yourself becoming greater throughout this experience. Again, you didn't. Yeah. You're not surviving it with a limp. You are greater yeah. than you were. Why is that important for you to really truly embrace and understand?
Because I think that if I don't embrace it, it's a bad thing. This is what I am, you know. There's no other way I can be, and so, you know, I do have like issues with balance, you know, and that's one of the things that I lost. I do have issues with balance. And certain things are hard for me, but like, this is who I am, and I embrace that. This is, you know, and I think that in doing that, I've become more in facing these things, and then going down further down that path, you know, to see where does that go if I accept this, as opposed to sitting there denying it, which I think is a worse path. But like going with it has made me greater, and that's where that comes from.
I wonder if after writing this book and also giving the TED Talk that this book kind of is centered around, have you heard from other young women who have maybe undergone something traumatic or painful or debilitating who kind of have looked at it differently after reading what you've written?
Yeah, I have, and it's been really amazing. It's interesting because there have been two things. Okay, so I've heard from readers who have been like, oh, you know, thank you for this, because this has gotten me to look at what I'm going through in a different light, and that was really important, and I needed that to start kind of looking at this, to start moving in a more positive direction. And they're like, thank you, because I want to accept what I am, and it's hard because I'm constantly being told I have to try to be this thing that I can never be. So there's that, and that's been great to hear, because that was part of my mission. I've also heard from, I think, three people who have had the surgery and had this happen to them, which has been interesting, and two of them have never walked again. So that's been something I'm thinking long and hard about, but it's given a lot of people something to really think and discuss.
My guest this hour is Nnedi Okorafor. Her book is Broken Places and Outer Spaces, Finding Creativity in the Unexpected. Nnedi, thank you so much for such a great conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.